Imagine yourself rafting down a river you've never traveled before. You know you've hit some gnarly rapids when you find it hard to think about anything more than how am I going to get through these? How long are they going to go on? And are the next stretches going to get even more bumpy? You know, we're in a moment like that right now with both the economy and the markets. Wouldn't it be nice if we could take a breather, zoom out, and get a big picture historical perspective? Then maybe we'd have a better idea about how the rough ride we're experiencing now might resolve. Stay tuned as the RLS boys, with the help of the latest edition of J.P. Morgan's Guide to the Markets Chartbook, discuss the past and debate its implications for today, right now on the Retirement Lifestyle Show.
Welcome. You are listening to the Retirement Lifestyle Show with Roshan Lungani, Eric Olson, and Adrian Nicholson. This show is an exploration of ideas to help you work toward your ideal retirement. Get ready for the financial independence of your dreams.
Welcome to the Retirement Lifestyle Show. I'm your co-host, Roshan Lungani, here with Eric Olson and Adrian Nicholson. For the first time, we are three married men on this podcast.
Yay.
Congratulations, Adrian.
Go, Adrian.
Yes, we are. Fist bump. I was showing off the ring for all of our
listeners. Cool.
I went with a gold classic. It matches a gold chain I have, so it was a really good fit.
Oh, fantastic.
We have to talk more about it towards the end of the podcast. We'll talk all about it. I'm really excited to get into
that. I mean, all three of us were there, and so we had a chance to really experience the full thing. So I do want to talk about it, especially some big risks you took by letting your brother be the guy who did this, your best man speech. I thought that was
phenomenal,
a risky play.
You did a phenomenal job. I appreciate that. Thank you. It was a great time, and I was really happy both of you were there. Really appreciate it, guys.
Yeah.
It's the first time we've all been in a room together. Surprising it over all
these
years. Is
that right? Wow.
Yeah.
That is right.
There's been
I just realized that now. Yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah. Conferences with two out of three of us more than once, but not all three.
I know. I haven't seen Eric since Chicago at the conference.
That's right.
A year ago. So that was nice seeing you again over the weekend. And I see Roshan pretty much every day.
Yeah. Oh, so true. That was great. Yeah. All right. Well, we got a great topic for today. Roshan, you want to introduce it?
Yeah. So today we're going to, JP Morgan does a great job. They put out their guide to market. So it's got a lot of data. So for three guys that are data heads, this is something we could literally, and probably did in preparation, spend hours on. Now, where we think this is valuable for everyone listening is we're going to go through some of the slides that stood out to us, and it really gives us a good opportunity to see the forest from the trees, so to speak. Look at the markets overall, look at what's going on, and that view is very different from when you're into the day-to-day swings, the day-to-day headlines of the market. So we think hopefully this will be very valuable for everyone listening. It'll help ground you, and I'm sure what Adrian does a great job of saying when we're caught too deep in what's going on the day-to-day is to take a step back and look at your plan. I'm sure we'll be saying that again today. So guys, let's jump in. We all reviewed this guide to markets, and we've all picked slides that we think stand out. So we can start by rotating through.
Sure.
Eric, why don't you, Adrian, why don't you go first? Your first day back, married man,
yes.
What slide stood out to you first?
So the first thing that stood out to me in the article would be the value growth, large, mid, and small cap chart that I think was laid out very well. And it's about the performance of these investments in these sectors, in these areas. And I thought that was really helpful, especially from an investing standpoint, to kind of look at this data that they presented to us to really paint a picture on what performance has looked like. Did you guys see that section?
Yeah. Adrian, do you have the slide up? And if so, do you want to share it as you talk about
it? Yes, I did pull a snapshot of it. So I'll share my screen now and present it. So
if you've got the slide number.
So it's this section right here where it breaks down the year-to-date performance today. And then it also has the performance since the market low of March 2020. And I thought these numbers were pretty outstanding, especially from March of 2020 to today. These are some really big moves, as you guys can see here. What do you think?
Yeah, so let's share the numbers for the listeners really quickly. What we're looking at is a chart, and across the top, it says value, blend, and growth. And then on the left side, it says large, mid, and small. And then across that, we've got various performance levels. So just for example, just because this is the biggest loser this year, large cap growth year to date is down 26.6%. Now, below that, it says, how's it done since its March lows? And large cap growth is up 73.2% since then. So in spite of this decline, it's still doing well if you take a step back from the year 2022 and go all the way back to 2020. You know, what's interesting to me, and this could be just that it's on my mind because I happen to be reading a book about this right now, but large value from March 2020 lows is up 86.4. So it's greater than large growth. And year to date, it's down 9.3% versus the 26.6%. Another data point that I'll say stands out to me on here, just the value slide looks really good in general when you compare both, but I'm surprised to see the best performer since the March 2020 lows is small value. And year to date, which is up 114.1%. And year to date, it's only down 11.2. That's very, granted, it's a little narrow data set. We're only looking a couple years, but that's a compelling argument to swim in the small value space.
Exactly. Yeah. The small cap value since March of 2020 has really knocked it out the park. And how Eric mentioned, it's really important to look at data, historical averages. They are very important. But this should never be something you're making one decision on that's letting drive all your performance, your plan, whatever it may be. It's good to look at the data just to see how they perform and look at different areas. But again, we're looking at so much data here. We're going to be going over so much data that it's really hard to base and make a decision off of just one point, where you have to look at all different pieces of information and apply it to your own situation. That's always extremely important. And granted, it's always hindsight bias, where there's probably is one piece of data maybe within this article that might be the key to what next year lies ahead, but it's really hard for people to make that prediction going forward. So that's really how I wanted to kick this one off today.
I just want to also comment. I mean, it's been such a long, long time for value investors to sort of be sitting there sort of trying to stick to their discipline and defend the approach that they're using as they watched growth stocks just crush value for years and years. And now you've started to see this reversal, and which isn't to say that it'll be enduring. We don't know. We don't have a crystal ball in that way. But I do think it is so fascinating to see, just, I mean, as you pointed out, year to date, large growth versus large value. Large growth is down almost three times as much through the first 9 months of the year, or 10 months of the year, I mean to say. So in that sense, the robust capacity of oftentimes dividend paying, not always, but oftentimes dividend paying value stocks serves as to provide a buffer against what otherwise would be a downturn. I was looking at another one of the value strategies that I run just yesterday, and just looking at where that was year to date. And it was down 5 because of, you know, in part because it's paying out a 7% dividend. So that works. Anyway, you've got something, Roshan.
Well, this isn't one of my picks, as I mentioned. I've selected the most of them. I'm trying to pare them down, so I'm giving Adrian credit or blame for this one. But I think it's just worth noting, Eric, what you had said. This chart on the left is valuations of relative growth versus value, mm-hmm. and you just see how how they've done one versus the other, you know, the growth versus value and performance. And that, I think, underlies, Eric, what you've said about this is forward PE ratio. So it shows sort of opportunities that are that are available. And what's interesting to me on this is now, as happens many times when markets go down, you've got growth stocks that are now in the value space. So you'll have some value investors that might start picking up some of these growth stocks because they're cheap enough. Another thing I'll just point out, I mentioned the book I'm reading, which I like so far. We may break it down in a future episode. It's called The Case for Long-Term Value Investing by Jim Cullen. And his argument in the book, and you know, with the title, you can tell he's arguing for value investing. But his whole argument is really showing in this environment. It's that, look, you're going to underperform when you get these high-flying markets, but your underperformance will be minor.
Hey, bring that.
And then you're going to outperform.
I'm sorry. I thought you were done. Finish your thought.
I was just going to say you're going to outperform in up market, in down markets, but and your outperformance in down markets will be significant. And we're seeing that based on what Adrian showed. But you were saying, Eric, bring that slide back up
because for our listener, I just want to describe what is being shown here. So on a trailing base or on a forward basis, we mean this is so you, it involves a little bit of uncertainty here because you're having to say what you project will be earnings for various companies. And that's something of an imprecise business. But if we can trust that for a second, what it's saying is that if you're looking forward in the United States on the value category, broadly speaking, the forward price to earnings ratio is 13.5. What does that mean? That means that you would basically pay $13.50 to buy a stock that's generating a dollar of earnings. If you go to the growth category, you're going to be paying $22.04 for that same dollar of earnings. Now you might be saying, well, why wouldn't everybody pay the $13 it's a little bit small here, but $13.50 instead of paying $22 for that same dollar of earnings? The answer is that the long-term growth rate of the growth stocks is the bargain, or at least is the reward that buyers of growth stocks historically are shooting for. What you can see on the chart, if you're watching, but I'll just describe it if you're listening, is that this ratio is almost always offset in that way. It's rare that they are equivalent forward price to earnings ratio. So what's normal, the long-term average is that the value stocks are only about 70% of their price to earnings ratio is commonly only about 70% of the price to earnings ratio of growth stocks. So you have to put it into perspective. But even now, where as of the end of October, that ratio is all the way down to six tenths of the price to earnings ratio of growth stocks. This chart shows growth has been beating down value for a long, long time. That's what for our viewers, as you watch that downward slope on the right hand side, that means that growth is continuing to trounce value. But recently, this is the point here, recently that started to reverse. And so now value is coming up, and in effect, how's that happening? It's because the value stocks are rising while the growth stocks are falling. So we'll see if this
or falling less.
Let's put it that way. Rising, falling less versus falling farther, I guess is the distinction.
Yeah. Just because they're both down.
They're both down
this year.
Yeah.
And Eric, did you have what slide did you have picked out next? And do this based on what you think is most important, because I have a feeling we're gonna have to
truncate some things here. Okay, no, that's yes, totally fine. So what I'll do here is share a slide having to do with growth rates in the economy. There's a lot of conversation about are we heading into recession? And people have been asking this, and it's been for sure we're going to hit recession next year, and the Fed is driving us into recession. As I've said over and over and over, I am a fence sitter on this question. It could very well be the case that we do run into a recession next year. But I will just say, as a sort of promising sign here now that the third quarter has come to a close and then numbers have been issued for the third quarter during the October. Remember, the quarter ends at the end of September. So during October, numbers were issued. And what we saw is that while the first and second quarters of 2022 were down, and remember, we had a lot of conversation about that. Does too, insofar as the sort of rule of thumb definition of recession historically has been two consecutive quarters of the GDP shrinking. Then does that in real terms, we're talking about inflation adjusted terms. Then does that mean we're in recession already? And I guess you could at that technical level say yes, but as I said, I don't think there's a lot of things in this economy that just don't make sense. They don't look or feel at all like the conventional understanding of what a recession is. Well, here when we saw third quarter numbers, what we saw was, okay, that reversed again. And so now we actually had 2.6% growth in on a quarterly basis in the economy, which year on year then means, this isn't spectacular, but year on year, what that means is that the economy is 1.8% larger in real terms than it was the year before. So I want to show another slide that sort of also gets to this, which is still part of this recession conversation. This has to do with labor demand. And so what the argument has been is, wow, we have incredible demand for labor. Look at on the left-hand side of the screen here for our viewers and then for our listener. Let me just describe. This is going back to 1973 on the far left side of this graph, and it's all the way to the present time in August and September of 2022. And what it's showing is the ratio of job openings to job seekers. Just understand what that means. The higher the ratio means the more job openings that there are for per job seeker. And you'd think, well, wouldn't you be in balance if you were at 1 and 1 and 1? Yeah, you probably would be. Then there'd be an opening, theoretically speaking, for everyone who wanted a job. I guess the condition there is if they're qualified. But what you see is for most of the 70s and 80s and most of the early, you know, the first decade of the new millennium, that ratio was there might be 2/10 of to 7/10 of, somewhere in that, you know, less than half for every job seeker, there were less than 1/2 of job openings, meaning people are finding jobs scarce. Coming out of COVID, whoa, things flew up to the two jobs open for every job seeker, and we're still at 1.75. I look at that as just ridiculous opportunity for people to go find new work and to change jobs if they want to, if they have the skills to get upgrades or have in the kind of work that they're doing to get higher wages and so on and so forth. To me, that just doesn't look like recession. Well, the argument that they're oftentimes making in this is that, yeah, it's not the absolute level. It's it's the direction of things. And so if in the last few months or a couple of quarters, it's been dropping from two openings for each job seeker to 1.75 openings for each job seeker, then that means that's probably presaging a possible recession. I say, I guess we'll find out, but it just still seems to me when you look at these ratios of openings to seekers, it's very, very hard for me to understand how that fits the recession narrative.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and so Eric, I'll pull up one as well. Hold on. I'm sorry to interrupt, Adrian. I feel like these two definitely go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get us back to that slide. One that stood out that I actually said I'm not going to show today because we've got so much stuff, but it's on page 9. And this is, look at this chart on the right. It's the labor share of income and profit margins. Mm-hmm. So what this is showing is that corporations are at almost historic highs in terms of their profit margin, just shy of where it was around 2012 and then in the 1970s, and labor share of profit is almost at historic lows. We're at levels not seen, and I'm just eyeballing the chart, but roughly since the 50s. So going back to what you had just showed, Eric, and part of this is technology improvement. So corporations through technology are able to keep more of their profits. There's arguments out there that wages just haven't risen at the same pace, which you could argue, corporations keeping profits. As an investor, this may be a good thing, but if you're using labor as a guide to recession, you could argue that looking that far back historically doesn't quite line up.
Well, mm-hmm. you've switched yes. charts, but I just want to comment about that chart again. That's a 70-year look back, and so what you saw was that the labor share of profit was fairly consistent from 1950 to 2000. I mean, it was in a range. You can see it vacillated back and forth from somewhere around 51% to as high as 55%. We're talking about a fairly narrow range, yeah. low 50s. But starting mm-hmm. in 2000, and I would argue this is in part by virtue of just the explosion, as you pointed out, in technology, mm-hmm. and possibly also as to a certain extent as a byproduct of the recession that happened following the tech bubble bursting and so forth. But if you look at this, it's risen to about 58 in 2010, and it has stayed between 56 and 58 since about 2010. So it was that 10-year period of really just moving up from that 51-52% area to 58% area. In the big scheme of things, to me, that seems like that's an important move, but it also doesn't seem like it's blowing me away. Do you know what I'm saying? It's not like it's went from 40 to 70 or something along those lines.
Or you're saying looking at the 2010 to present data, it could be a new range could be developing similar to what we had from the 50s to really 2000.
Yeah, and I realized I just completely was looking at the wrong side of this. The black line is the labor share. So that has since about 2000 dropped from 57 to about 54. So in that sense, it just doesn't seem like it's that. It's the other element that I was mistaken about. The profit margin hovered, I should say, in the somewhere in the 5-8% area, and starting in about 2000, it went from the 5% area up to the 10% area. So that is a significant move that profit margins have increased that much. But if you say, hey, well, what is if you say once upon a time labor share of let's say a 5% profit margin, labor share was around half of that. They were getting about 2% of the company's revenue was coming to them in the form of their share of that profit. Whereas if you now say, hey, well, it's 54% of a 10% profit margin, their share has moved up to about 5%. So in absolute terms, labor has actually been reaping an increasingly bigger harvest from the activity of these companies. These companies' capacity to expand margins, while the share going to labor has declined a little bit, the absolute magnitude has increased substantially.
Great point, Eric. I'm glad we brought this up because I had not thought of it from that perspective. Until you mentioned it today. I'm going to go next and just show, and I'm going to cheat a little bit and show you three slides really quickly because I think they all go together.
Okay.
But just continuing with our conversation on unemployment and what we're talking about. Actually, let's go to inflation because I feel like we've discussed this before, mm-hmm. but I feel like inflation is what's driving everything right now. Mm-hmm. So if you look at this, we're looking at a chart from 1972 to present, and we're looking at inflation. Headline CPI is in blue, core CPI is in black, mm-hmm. and you just see how much inflation has gone up with headline CPI. Looking, it may have peaked. I don't want to say that definitively, but it may have peaked right under 9. But core CPI seems to be trending up. To me, that's the change that the September report brought that made me feel like things are of greater concern than I thought. Mm-hmm. I thought, and thinking that it'll take longer for the Fed to get this under control, the fact that the core went up, the difference between the two is primarily, and tell me if I'm wrong, energy and food prices are pulled out of core because they tend to have more volatility. Mm-hmm. So the core CPI is supposed to be more stable. That's why a lot of the Fed that focus on core versus headline. But it the last peak of September surpassed the previous peak of just a couple months before. So, gentlemen, any thoughts on this one before I go to the next one?
The main focus, too, with this is interest rates as well. It's hard not to talk about inflation and interest rates in the same sentence right now, because that's what everybody's talking about, is the tool to bring this down with the Federal Reserve tightening the money supply that's out there. That's what everybody's looking at.
Yeah, let me just describe this chart for our listener. So this is a 50-year chart going all the way back to 1972. And for the first 10 years of this chart, wow, the inflation swings are huge. If you were alive during that time, you undoubtedly remember inflation at points, you know, in the 10s, 12s, 14s, and so forth, during a very, very difficult period. And ultimately, it was the combination of Paul Volcker at the Federal Reserve jacking interest rates to unbelievable levels that slammed the door on inflation and brought it way back down to the 3 or 4% area. And over the subsequent period from the early 80s until just about the time when COVID hits, what you're seeing is core CPI, that meaning leaving out that more volatile energy and food, core CPI just is ebbing downward, 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 downward into the 2 and 1.5% area. Then suddenly, immediately following COVID, as we all have lived through, it goes whoosh and skyrockets higher again. So the interesting part is that if when you put it all together over that 50-year period, the headline CPI, again, headline includes food and energy, that's 4%. Core CPI over that entire 50-year period is also about 3.9%. By the way, if you're a planner, or you're a client of a planner, you should be asking the question, what sort of assumptions are you using this plan about long-term inflation? I don't think it's improper to use a 4% number as an approximate number at all. In fact, you might want to inch that up just a wee bit to introduce a slight degree of additional conservatism in it. The issue that we're seeing here, friends, is that the core CPI from August to September went up, while the headline CPI held steady. And a sister measurement to the CPI, which again, consumer price index, a sister is the PCE. That's the personal consumption expenditures, I think is what it stands for. While the headline is staying flat at 6.2, the core is increased from 4.9 to 5.1. What is that? Why is that a concern? The core, you would love to see, if anything, falling, and it's not. So
here's
stay
where
tuned.
I'm cheating on our one slide at a time, mm-hmm. and going to another one, because I said like these three go together. What we're looking at now is a breakdown of what contributes to headline inflation. So it's a chart from September 21 to September 2022. We're looking at different colors. Energy is in green. New and used vehicles are in red. What stood out to me when you look towards the right side the last couple months, the only thing that seems to really have been dropping is new and used cars, right? If you look at this, energy ticked down, but ever so slightly. New and used cars went down significantly. Food at home was going up, others going up, restaurants and is going up, and so is shelter. So to me, I don't see how, once again, I mentioned many times how September's report scared me. Well, what scared me about September is energy went down, and one of the things receiving the most complaints were how much new and used cars were being priced because of supply chain shortages. Well, those went down. The two things that are complained about the most went down, and yet the overall headline CPI only went from 8.3 to 8.2, and the core went up. So to me, that was the first time I'd seen the data do that, and mm-hmm. that's what was concerning to me. Gentlemen, anything to add on this one?
Yes, the one thing I would add, if you could pull it up, it's where they talk about bear markets. And some people just associate or just think about immediately when they hear the word recession or inflation or just bad GDP numbers. It goes in line with a bear market. And I'll share my screen here to show some of the data after you take yours down, Roshan, where it shows the average duration of bear markets going from January 2022, this year, all the way back to September 1929, the average bear market duration is around 20 months. Now that October is over.
Let me give you the screen in 1 second. I just want to show one last thing because of what you talked about in line with this, which was the interest rates. You had said how interest yes. rates go with inflation. This is just a chart of where the Fed funds rate has been and how much it's gone up. And we've talked a lot about it's the fastest rate hike ever. We were below one, really at zero from 2009 till 2015. And then we went up and peaked out at about 2.5, dropped back down to zero during COVID 2020 to 2022. And now it's shot up to, you know, 3 to 3.25. It has it at 3.13. And you just see the expectations of it going way up, expecting it to peak in 24 and then potentially pull back. So I just wanted to line this up with the inflation piece before we move on to the bear market. The Fed's primary weapon for fighting or combating against inflation is raising the Fed funds rate. So if there's less money out there, you will lower inflation. And with the fastest rate hike in history, we still haven't seen it pull back as inflation, at least at the core level. We still haven't seen it really slow down. So that's the part that's concerning. And now I'm going to stop the share and go ahead and share yours, Adrian.
Yeah, it is concerning just experiencing those zero interest rate environments and then a fast, sharp upswing of interest rates. Definitely the markets were feeling the pain of this. So going back to what I was talking about as far as the bear markets, this data really highlights and shows you historically of what it's been like. And those numbers can be concerning and scary for people to see, where you see back in September 1929, there was a minus 86% drop, and it lasted around 32 months. So I want to just point people and highlight this section down here where the average is 20 months and the average decline was minus 41%. And now that we're in November right now, as we're recording this podcast, historically, you can say that we are at the halfway point of this. Obviously, things can change. It can be longer, it can break the average, or it could be shorter. But just looking at this historical data shows that we are at the halfway point for this average. So I thought that was lining up with what we're talking about as far as recession, inflation. These are all things people associate with bear markets.
Yeah, and interestingly on that slide, you talk about us being at the halfway point. We are at that from both the peak levels, and I'm trying to share this screen at the same time, from the peak levels and the duration, we've got the halfway point. What stood out to me on this is I question whether the averages line is this a situation where averages are not helpful to me. I keep pointing to the January 1973 just because that was an inflation driven decline. I'm not saying we're going down 48%, but interestingly, the duration is exactly at the average 20 months. 20 months would put us into September of 2023, as far as the duration goes. And that says a 48% decline based on where we are today, because the S&P has recovered a lot. It's got, we've got more than double the current loss if we were to hit that, which was a minus 48. The average is a minus 41. I also found this chart on the left they have compelling, which says, well, how long does it take to get to the peak? What kind of returns do we need? If it's a 5-year period, it would be an average of a 6.2. If it's 1 year, it'd be 25.7. So, and I'm trying to find the corresponding bull market after 73 to see how long that recovery took. It's not explicit on this chart here, but I remember that it took about 5 years almost to get back to where the peak was.
Mm-hmm. I think it can be very helpful sometimes to see the extremes of what the markets have done in the past and how long they can take to recover. It can be a way to look at a planning strategy where you're saying, okay, let's take that experience where the markets dropped 89% and look how long it took to recover. Put that in your plan and see what that looks like. Running multiple outcomes with all this data that we're presenting you today can really help with decision making and see where you're standing.
I definitely agree with that. I also look at that chart that we saw. Just some of these things to me, I would need to pull out. For example, February 2020, because it was the cause was the pandemic. I mean, it went down, but it's a 34% decline, and that lasted for 1 month. So that's going to skew the data way down, right?
Exactly.
That's going to pull the average way down.
Yes.
I guess I'm a little bit of a skeptic about some of that, because it seems to me there's a strong correlation, not perfect, but strong correlation between the depth of the decline and then the months to recovery. So it seems to me is, the question is how deep are we likely to go? Are we already there? And usually there is, what's the sort of catalyst for change? You might remember a few episodes back that I was talking about what I saw sort of cracks in the armor of the Federal Reserve and even more cracks in the armor of some of the other central banks around the world starting to express some hesitation about extending the rate hikes at the level that they had been committed to officially initially. So here too, in the United States, we're now saying, hey, this has been said now for a few weeks, but maybe what we should do is do a pause on the rate hikes and see how effectively they are actually serving to tame inflation before we just continue, you know, pedal to the metal to continue increasing these rates at the pace that we're doing. And if you look at what market expectations are now, there is somewhere in the neighborhood of about just a 50-50, or there's an 80% likelihood, says the market, that in December, there's a strong expectation that in November, that there will be indeed a 0.75% rate hike. I mean, we're talking about the meeting, I think, is today or tomorrow. But the December hike, which once upon a time had also been talked about at least as a 50 basis point or 0.5% increase, or potentially a 0.75% increase, now the market observers are starting to have some doubts about that. So
I got to interrupt you. I have to interrupt you. Two questions. First, has you heard or seen anything from any Fed board members saying they're going to slow things down?
Yes, I think I mentioned about three or four episodes ago that we'd seen the number two in charge, and then also I think the head of the Chicago Federal Reserve had in speeches started to express skepticism about the pace at which they were raising rates and wanting to see if in fact that, in order to avoid an almost certain recession as an outcome, whether they should ease off for a bit.
Yeah, and I haven't seen that since August, and then they came back in September, and that's when things really went south, you know, just mm-hmm. the speech is all going the other direction. And just of note, a lot of the market observers in August, after July's data came out, said in September it was going to slow down. So as you're skeptical of the chart we just reviewed, I'm skeptical of what these market observers are saying, because I remember back in March, I feel like sometimes they race to get a headline. I don't want to name the wrong company, so I won't name who it was. But back in March, companies were jumping up and down, trying to be the first to claim peak inflation's already hit.
I think what I'm saying,
right? So that,
yeah, go ahead. Finish your thought.
No, go ahead. I'm just saying that that makes me skeptical of what they're saying. I want to see data, and I want to see actual movement versus the speculation of the market observers. Just because as many of them are going to be right, you're going to have that many that'll be wrong, and you can find whatever opinion you want.
In this case, Roshan, I should have come prepared with this, because I didn't know we were going to actually get into this particular data point, because I thought we were going to stick with the JP Morgan Guide to the Market slides. But what I'm talking about is not at this point talking heads getting on the news programs or whatever and saying their forecasts. Instead, what I'm talking about is, I think it's the Fed Fund futures. If you look at Fed Fund futures and what they imply, so that is actually actions where people are actually betting money as opposed to just getting on a program and making pronouncements. And it's the Fed Fund futures that are indicating an increasing skepticism about the Fed's willingness to persist with the rate hike, at least at the pace at which they've indicated they initially indicated they would do. But I'd love to actually take up that topic another time to really get into the weeds a little bit more on how the Fed influences policy, as well as how to read some of the tea leaves about the market's bets on whether or not they have the resolve to persist.
Yeah, and I think I have somewhat of what you're. It's not exactly. It's the market expectations and what the Fed's saying, and I see this doesn't look like a dramatic difference, right? Actually, the market expectations right now is a long run rate of 4.04, whereas the Fed year end estimates, this is I believe the end of 2024, is 3.9. But if you go back a year for year end to the end of 2023, market expectation is 4.57 and the Fed's year end is 4.6. And market expectation versus Fed for the end of this year is market expectation is slightly higher. So I hear what you're saying. I just don't see that any change in expectation has really been that significant.
Okay. Well, we'll see. We shall see. I have been advocating for the Federal Reserve to maintain its resolve, although I've said that that's I think it's more important that they maintain resolve on money supply than on interest rates. But the nevertheless, I'll be happy if you're right.
Yeah, and I'm not saying they will or they won't. I guess I've just I want to see it, or at least I want to see the move versus hearing market prognosticators talk about it, just because I feel like they've been talking about stuff like this for a while and they've as a whole been wrong. And in addition to that, as I said, I just feel like you can find any opinion out there. Let's go on to the next slide or next section. Eric, actually, I think it's your turn to pick one to share.
Yeah. Okay. Well, since Adrian, you had sort of shifted us off of the discussion of inflation and talking more about what's going on, what our expectations should be about markets, let me talk a little bit about markets. So I'm going to pull up this slide. So this, we had begun earlier in this conversation talking about valuations, and I want to also now talk a little bit about consumer confidence and the consumer sentiment index, and then what has typically happened in subsequent 12-month S&P 500 returns. So what we're looking at is a chart going back to 1971 and running up to the present. So it's essentially a 51-year period of time. And on the left-hand axis, the vertical axis, is the this index, this consumer sentiment index. And the ranges are from about 50 at the low end to a little bit more than 110 at the high end. What are some examples of instances where consumer sentiment was extremely negative? Well, one of those was, you probably can understand, in thinking back just a little while, was a month or two ago in August or whatever, where it was down to about, this consumer sentiment index was maybe at an all-time low of 50%. And other times when it was really low, it was at the end of 2008. In November of 2008, it got down to maybe about 55. Back, if your memory extends back this far, back to the early 80s, May of 1980, it was down to maybe 52 or something like that. Where has it been at the high? Well, in January of 2020, people were just super, super bullish. Consumers were, the sentiment index was super, super positive. It was way above 110. And actually, just before COVID hit, it was also at a pretty high. It was slightly more than 100, as it had been through most of 2018, 2019, and until that point when COVID suddenly became a reality in people's minds. So it can swing all over the place. But what's interesting is that if you look at the eight intermediate peaks along this chart, the next 12-month S&P 500 return has averaged 4.1%. But if you look at the eight troughs in this chart, the average 12-month return to the S&P 500 subsequently has been, brace yourself, 24.9%. In other words, said again, 4% when you're at a peak, 25% essentially when you're at a valley. We're just coming off a valley. And so at this point, if we think back to maybe a couple months ago, if that pattern were to hold, and I'm not saying that it will, but if that pattern were to hold, then we might think in terms of, wow, if the coming 12 months, meaning until late summer, early fall of 2023, could we see during this period a substantial increase in the S&P 500's value? Gentlemen, reactions.
Yeah, I look at this. This was one that I had highlighted as well. Interestingly, that I keep going to that book I'm just finished, but he had said, and whenever it's below 60, he viewed it as a buying opportunity. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that. So for all of our listeners, consult your advisor. This is all data. This is just for you to think about and review and make some decisions on your own with your advisor. And we're always there to help if you want to reach out to us directly. But the one thing I do question about this is I don't know this either. Did it bottom last month or not? It's easy to see in hindsight, but I look at November 08 number and you do see it go down, go in what looks like probably September. And then it shoots up in October and then drops back down in November. Mm-hmm. This is going to be looking at 2008. Mm-hmm. And you've got a couple instances like that, March of 03, where you've got that almost double bottom type thing, February 75. So I'm not arguing it's at a bottom or not at a bottom. I'm just making the point that we won't know until we see the next month's report whether, you know, last month was a bottom and this is a trend, or is this a one-time move up that'll be pulled back down. Even if you look at right now, you go back and look at the last few months and you see that it kind of goes down, spikes up, goes down and spikes back up. So I don't know. I think this is very valuable to see what people are thinking. I think the data points of what happens all in the future is also worth looking at. But this does not necessarily call a mark. This doesn't call a market bottom either.
No, for sure. This, it does not do that. That absolutely agree.
Guys, I'm going to ask if you have any final one to share and anything that you think is worth parting thoughts with the slides on your list. And a last one.
I have one more. It's still related to markets since we're on the market topic. But Adrian, do you have one?
Yeah, I'm all set. You can go ahead, Eric.
Okay. So This one, again, is looking at markets, but from a slightly different standpoint this time. This is looking at valuations. And on particular, on the right-hand side, we're looking at global valuations. So global valuations, this is dividing the globe into five broad regions: the U.S., Japan, Europe, emerging markets, not including China, and then China in general. And what it's looking at is the current price-to-earnings ratios, the 25-year price-to-earnings ratios, and the next 12 months, price-to-earnings ratios. So what I think the key thing to understand here is that the current price-to-earnings ratios in some of these cases are substantially lower than what is the 25-year average. Now, in the U.S., it's actually right about the 25-year average, at currently at 16.7. Again, price to earnings, for those of you who are thinking, what does that mean? That means the amount you'd have to pay, in this case, $16.70, you'd have to pay to buy a share that will generate a dollar of earnings to the company. That's the U.S. in line with its 25-year earnings now. But in Japan, it is near the bottom of its 25-year range at $12.50 for each dollar of earnings. In Europe, it's not quite at the bottom, but it's certainly at the lowest quarter of its 25-year range at $11.10 for a dollar of earnings. In the emerging markets, it's probably in the bottom third, slightly below its long-term average. It's $10.40. And if you go to China, it's almost near the very, very bottom of its 25-year range, $8.30 for a dollar of earnings. When I look at that, I think, okay, I don't know that necessarily means, I'm again, not calling a bottom. This is for sure not a recommendation to run out and buy. Talk with your advisor about what's appropriate for you. But if you're just looking at, you're trying to balance the good with the bad, generally speaking, you would rather be a buyer when you're at the lower ranges of long-term historical range, you know, at the lower end of a long-term historical range than at the top end, I would argue.
Yeah, the one challenge I have to this is I think you really need to compare interest rate environment and the fact that we've had such, if interest rates are low, that typically leads to higher ratios, PE ratios. You've got interest Fed funds rates at zero for at least a third to half of that 25-year period. So I wonder if that average, if you were to add interest rates, should be a little bit lower. That'd just be an interesting data point I'd like to see. I've got one final slide that I want to share, which interestingly enough is the one of the first slides on the chart here, the JP Morgan chart. And give me a moment. It's the S&P, and they're saying, is the S&P at an inflection point? That's this chart right here, and you've got from 1996 to present, you've got the S&P where it is, and then they also mark peaks and troughs with a green dot that it includes where the S&P was, what the forward PE ratio is, what the dividend yield is, and what the treasury yield is. So I look at this chart. I'd love both of your thoughts on this. I'm looking specifically up to what was actually a close to the peak level of October 2007. And I picked that out because you've got the 10-year treasury at 4.7% where it's at 4.1. And that number in October 2007 peaks at a PE of 15. And a dividend yield of 1.9, and that was prior to the 2009 bottom, March 9th of 2009. So October 9th, 2007 is the peak. And I wonder, what I'm looking at this chart, especially with the dots they have, is I'm trying to read the tea leaves and say, all right, well, is this saying we're at a bottom and turning up? Or if we compare it when we add in the interest rate overlay and say, well, look, October 9th of 07, and we're basically still above the 07 peak. Gentlemen, any thoughts on this one? Any insight? Help me see the future.
Adrian, do you have thoughts about this?
It's a great chart when I see this. When you really expand it all out, it still looks like we're at a solid high. But when you look at performance for the year, it's down. But what do you think, Eric?
Well, I think this chart, which is 20, if I'm doing the math right, 25, 26 years inclusive, is a mm-hmm. is a story about Federal Reserve intervention. And what quantitative easing does to drive a market from around, you know, 677, this is the S&P 500 index, from 677 in early 2009 to reaching a peak in January of almost 4,800. And so essentially, you think about that. That's nearly, you know, that's nearly a sevenfold increase in that period of time. What drives that? Well, and part of it is multiple expansion. You can see that the price to earnings ratio in March of 2009 was just over 10. And the price to earnings ratio in January of 2022 at a relative peak was 21 and change, meaning you had to pay twice as much for every dollar of earnings that a stock represented. How does it get that? That's, we would call that a doubling of the multiples, and not necessarily earnings driven.
And just because you had mentioned, your interpretation is it's sort of Fed policy and manipulation from 09 to 2016. So that's almost a seven year period. You've got less than 1%, close to zero rates, and then again from 2020 to 2022. Mm-hmm. So we're talking 13-year time period, where of those 13 years, you've got 9 where you're at zero.
Yeah.
Right. So your interpretation, just going back to the chart with PE, well, I think that's a very interesting point that I hadn't thought of. The perspective I was looking at this as, and what I'm trying to use this to see is directionally, do I think which way do I think we're headed, and what do I compare it to? But that's another really good perspective of, well, this is what happens when Fed rates are that low. The question then I'd have, or the argument is, well, if they keep pushing up rates, are they going to drive it all the way back to those levels? Are they going to lead us into a recession? I don't know the answer to that. I'll tell you, I've heard since 2000, back to that 2009 period, a very frequently used phrase has been, "Don't fight the Fed." Mm-hmm. So is being bullish fighting the Fed right now? I don't know if the answer to that. It's just an interesting thought or point I'd add, just on with that chart we just looked at, and Eric, your interpretation, which I really liked, of that chart of is that what happens when the Fed manipulates the market? If that's the case, are they manipulating it the other way right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, gentlemen, we're almost at an hour, and this has been a fascinating discussion, but I think we need a pivot. And I think we need to talk about the magic that happened this last Saturday. Adrian, yeah, oh my goodness. What does it feel like to be, this is day five of being a married man, inclusive of your wedding day?
Yes, I feel a lot. There's a lot of words I can use. I'll just say it feels lovely, lovely right now.
Oh, that's good. It was such a
Adrian,
thrill to
I've
be there.
I've got to say, your speeches were, your Adrian gave, I guess I'll call him speech, Adrian's vows, and then he gave a speech at the dinner. They were incredible. Mm-hmm. I think you have a secondary calling as a speechwriter.
I appreciate that. I had a lot of time to prepare. Alex had vow books for us to write them in, so I spent a lot of time with that. We've been together for so long, there was a lot to say, and a lot of people say my speeches were incredible. They liked it a lot, and my wife, Alex, made it easy because she's so great. She's so awesome, and it was awesome. The day was amazing beginning to end, and that's what we were looking for.
I think we're going to pull out that last section and send that to Alex.
I mean, I've been saying this stuff to her the past 5 days, so she's been getting a lot of it. Some of my favorite moments that come to mind is when I first saw her. That was incredible. The kiss where we finally became husband and wife. That was incredible. And then third, just dancing with her and everybody all night long. That was awesome. Roshan, I hope you liked the music.
I loved it. It was great. Had a great time. I love seeing you doing that Drake verse on Sicko Mode out there on the middle of the dance floor. Everyone surrounding. Well, Adrian did an impromptu concert. So it was great.
I danced a lot, but I was so happy that you guys were there. It was awesome. It was really awesome. Mm.
Well, it was a privilege to be there. And Adrian, you know, usually, and I don't want to say this is 100% true, but usually guys are not known for necessarily a lot of depth in their sort of expression of their, you know, profundity necessarily in moments like this. Usually are kind of expecting that the woman is going to probably have given a little bit more thought to it. And the extent to which you had really reflected on what Alex meant to you and what that journey had been like as you, from the time of knowing her until now, I thought that was really fantastic. So I wanted to give you, you know, big kudos for having, not to take anything away from what Alex said, but just to highlight, since expect the bar's usually kind of low for guys, you could have gotten above that, the expectation bar pretty easily, but you way overshot it. And so congratulations to you for really honoring your wife with that, the depth of your reflection that way.
Yes, I'm glad you said that word.
Actually, yeah, and you know what is interesting is, Eric, what you said is after Alex gave her vows, she said something like, Adrian's going to show me up now. And Adrian responds with, how could I show up someone so beautiful? I was like, what a great moment.
Those were two parts that were improv or I came up with on the spot where Alex in her vows said, you're probably going to upstage me on your vows. Yes. And I looked towards everybody saying, I can't upstage someone so beautiful. And then the second part that was I came up with on the spot is when Pastor Todd told me to place the ring on her finger and I was going to do it the entire way. He's like, don't do it the entire way yet. And I said, I'm just ready to be married. So those two parts everybody liked a lot. Those were really good. And I appreciate those kind words that you guys are saying. I mean, it was a very emotional day. It's one of the most emotional moments of my life, but it was also just really fun just after everything was done, after all the photos, just really going in there and just celebrating and dancing and talking to everybody and seeing all these different people in my life come together in one place, just getting to meet each other and celebrate family, friends, coworkers, everybody. It was a lot. And I'm still processing it right now. I'm just processing so much. And it's just such a great feeling.
I thought another cool
about 10 episodes. About 10 episodes from now, we will break down the wedding pictures like we broke down this JP Morgan slide deck.
Sounds good. Sounds
you know, good. One of the things, Adrian, I thought also was really great was your brother's tribute to you. A lot of times, you know, that's a risk because sometimes a brother can just be brutal thinking that that's funny. And you've probably been to your share of weddings where you just wince when you listen to the way in which the best man, in this case your brother, just levels the groom. But in this case, his tribute to you is also really loving and respectful, and I was very impressed by his comments as well.
He did an awesome job. I was really happy with his speech. Like I said, from beginning to end, the wedding was amazing, and I was glad there was no awkward moments, no cringe moments, no moments where we look back and we're like, oh man, what? Like you said, bar the speeches, everything went great. The whole day went great. And shout out to my brother, Isaiah. It was an incredible best man speech. I'm sure you all like the maid of honor speech where she said, Alex is a spender and Adrian's the saver. So that's why they're perfect for each other. That part was very clever. And I like that as well. So I thought you two definitely like that part a lot.
I was loving that. I was at a comedy show probably two weekends before that, and one of the lines in there was, "You need a marriage where you have both, because otherwise, if both people are trying to set the fun record all the time, you'll be bankrupt in 2 weeks."
Perfectly balanced.
Yeah, that was a great line. I literally looked at Steph, who was sitting to my left, and I was like, my wife, and I was like, yeah, it's true.
That was great. All speeches were great. And it was just the dance floor, too. We have a lot of good videos of that. That was awesome.
One more person I want to give a big shout out to is your dad. I thought, sometimes it's all gushy and sort of lame and empty. And it sounds like it's been said, a million times before. It's just you could have gone onto the internet and just downloaded something. Your dad really had a very thoughtful commentary. I just thought, man, this is a guy with a lot of wisdom and a lot of perspective, and really took the role of being a father to the groom in a very serious way. So I was really, really impressed by what he had to say.
Yes, I appreciate that. He laid a great foundation for me growing up, both my parents and my brother. My family was just awesome. And I really appreciate that, Eric. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the entire Nicholson family. I got to talk to your mom for a little bit, and your dad. They were great. You get to meet your brother. Even your mother-son dance where you got your mom to get a little wild with you and drop it low when you got went down.
We were
the Sinatra.
Practicing.
That was great.
Yeah, we were actually did you really practice that? A couple of days, and we were very just conservative. Oh, she's nice. Like, I don't want to do a lot. I just want to do like a few things. Let's keep it simple. And then on the wedding day, when we're actually performing the dance, she really just had the best time and had so much fun with it. So I was really happy she took it to the next level when we were practicing. I was just like, okay, just keep it simple, I guess. But that day she blew me away. So that was awesome. But that makes me happy, like what you all are saying. I just really love when people come to me and say, hey, I met this person here that you always talk about, or I met this person, or two of my friends who we were really close with and we haven't really seen each other, and we all came together and we're just reminiscing, having a good time. It was just awesome. And I can't thank Alex, my wife, and her mother, my mother-in-law, Karen, for just doing such a good job planning such a great wedding. 16 months of wedding planning. It's can sometimes be more intense than financial planning, honestly.
I bet. All right.
Well, congratulations again.
Yeah.
And for everyone that's with us, thank you for listening. Please like, subscribe, give us 5 stars. We'll be back next week with another great episode. This has been the Retirement Lifestyle Show.
Schedule a conversation with Roshan, Adrian, or Eric today at retirementlifestyleshow.com. Roshan and Eric are certified financial planner practitioners. They, along with Adrian, are investment advisor representatives and serve clients across the U.S. with financial planning and investment advice through Arete Wealth. If you found this show helpful, gained knowledge, or enjoyed the time you spent with us, tell your friends and leave us a 5-star review. This will help others discover the show. To access our show notes, to download any of the tools mentioned in today's podcast, to ask us a question, or to schedule a conversation, go to retirementlifestyleshow.com. All opinions expressed by podcast hosts and guests are solely their own. While based on information they believe is reliable, neither Arete Wealth nor its affiliates warrants its completeness or accuracy, nor do their opinions reflect the opinion of Arete Wealth. This podcast is for general informational purposes only and should not be regarded as specific advice or recommendations for any individual. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. The show hosts offer investment advice through Arete Wealth Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor, and securities through Arete Wealth Management, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC, and NFA. Finally, our music is The Chance
by Jason Shaw in Audionautics. It's part of the YouTube Audio Library, and it's licensed under a Creative Commons license. I am Ray Voices. Thank you for listening.